This week is a double parsha of Matot and Maaseh, which also have a tremendous amount of very interesting items for us to examine. Just a brief overview of both parshios. Parshas Maaseh begins with the laws of Nedarim, the laws of vows. If you make a vow, you have to fulfill that which you obligate yourself to do, or refrain from that which you've created a barrier. And it's very interesting how women have really a separate law within the laws of Nedarim, how a husband or a father could nullify a vow when they hear it being said and saying, you don't have to fulfill it. It's very fascinating. All the laws of Nedarim, not something we're going to deal with today, but nonetheless fascinating. Torah moves on to the war of Midian. We know that Midian was and Moab were in cahoots together in sending out their women to seduce the Jewish people, and that was the whole story of Pinchas, where Pinchas came and put an end to this by killing the princess of Midian with the prince of the tribe of Shimon. And since there was a tremendous plague and a tremendous result from this action of these women coming out seducing Jewish people, it wasn't only into acts of promiscuity, it was into avodah zarah, into idol worship as well, Baal Peor. Now God says, now's the time to take revenge on Midian. It's the war of Midian, which goes on for a tremendous amount of time. Not only the war, but more particularly all the spoils they bring back and the whole process of dividing up the spoils. We have the story of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, who say we have a lot of cattle. You know, the land of that we just conquered, of Sihon and Og, and the other half of the Jordan, you know, it's good for pasture. And if you look carefully in the Torah, that's all they say. That land's good for pasture. We have a lot of cattle. And then there's a break. Samach, in the Torah, there's a break. As if they wanted Moshe to pick up on it and say, gee, cattle, pasture, maybe you want to stay there. They wait. Moshe doesn't say anything. And then they make their request. Because clearly, to not want to live in Eretz Yisrael proper is an incorrect thing. And Moshe Rabbeinu gets very angry at them, and only on condition that they'll go ahead and fight first and then come back, they can live in that part of the land. And then per se, Parshas Maaseh deals with the Masa'ot, the travels of the Jewish people from Egypt to the border of the land of Israel, and then it ends with the laws of Ir Miklat, the laws of a person kills by accident, and it goes to a city of refuge, and those cities of refuge was the tribe of Levi. Six cities in particular, or any of the 48 Levite cities, could be used to shelter this person who killed by accident so that none of the close relatives would be able to kill him. And he stayed there until the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, died. Also a very fascinating law. So among all these fascinating laws to choose from, we chose the War of Midian. The War of Midian. Not one of the most fascinating, but it really is. So let's take a look at the War of Midian. I'd like to study this section together once again on two levels. Torah tells us in source number 1 that Moshe spoke to the people saying, arm for yourselves men for an army to wage war on Midian. From all tribes of Israel you shall send to war. And Rashi on the spot notes, from all tribes of Israel, including the tribe of Levi. Now that's highly unusual. Because if we know that, for example, at the beginning of the book of Amidbar, when the Jewish people are counted, Levi is not counted among everyone else. Why? Because they are Legionosha Melech, they're really the army of God, and they're not part of the army of the Jewish people. They never fought. We didn't send out from the tribe of Levi a spy to spy out the land. They're not involved in military conquest. Throughout, Levi never fought in a war except Midian. Very interesting. So question number 1 is, what is it about this war that even Levi is included? And we know the rabbis tell us, send for out for yourselves men. These men were tzaddikim, were the most righteous people being sent out. You had to be really righteous to qualify to fight in this war. Also seems a little bit unusual. When they come back from the war, and they have all this spoil and all this booty in front of them, so the Torah tells us in source 2, Elazar the Kohen said to the men of the legion who came to the battle, this is the decree of the Torah, again, Zot Chukat HaTorah, which Hashem commanded Moshe, only the gold and the silver, the copper, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that comes into fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it will be purified. But it must be purified with the water of sprinkling, and everything that will not come in the fire, you shall pass through the water. This is the law of tefillas kelim, of immersion of vessels into a mikvah. The Torah tells us, source 3, that the metal utensils that the Israelites brought back as spoiled had to undergo a special purification before they could be used. If they were cooking utensils that were used over fire, which comes through fire, they'd have to be kosher, made kosher by heating and fire, as is indeed the law. This, however, is not enough. Before these vessels could be used, they would also have to be purged in the water for a nida that is immersed in the same kind of mikvah required for a nida. Utensils not used over the fire need only be washed thoroughly and immersed. From this we learn two things. First, we see that all metal utensils made by a non-Jew must be immersed before they can be used. Secondly, we learn that when vessels must be kosher, that should be done before their immersion. And he goes on to explain this in Rabbi Kaplan's book, Water of Eden. Our sages liken the table to an altar, and therefore every utensil used on the Jewish table must be sanctified, just like vessels used on the altar of the Holy Temple. This is part of a Jew sanctifying every element of his life. But once again, this is called a chukat haTorah, a decree, which means we don't necessarily understand why we do it. Let's analyze this section for a number of moments, and then we'll begin our study. We note here, as we noted a number of parshios ago, that in describing this section of the purification of the vessels that came from the war, the Torah calls it Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the decree of the Torah, not a more specific language. This is the decree of the laws of immersion, or the laws of purification. And as we spoke about at length in Parshat Chukat, the same concept follows here. We're not just dealing here with laws of immersion. We're dealing here with Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the law that has ramifications for all of Torah. That's why perhaps on a parenthetical level, the Balei Mussar learned from here that this is the concept of tshuva, of repentance. If you sin in a passion of fire, so your repentance has to be with a passion of fire. And if you sin with cold intellect, water, so then your repentance is done more of a cold intellectual way. So Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the law of the Torah. It's not only specifically for the law of immersion. It's a much larger scheme here. It's that in all levels, that the way that something becomes impure or comes to a level of impurity, that's the way you bring it to a level of purity. Likewise, within our own self, the way we sin is the way we have to do repentance. But nevertheless, we have to understand here that this section is much deeper than just the law of immersion. So we have to understand, as our second question, what is the deeper significance of the law of immersion? That Zot Chukat HaTorah, it's a general law of the Torah. And finally, I think we need to try to struggle with, which Rabbi Kaplan tried to deal with a little bit, is what is the significance, what is the symbolism of immersion in a mikvah? Why do we take vessels, whether it's metal, whether it's glass, and before we use them, anything made by a non-Jew, before we use them, we immerse them in a mikvah, in a pool of water? What is the symbolism, what is the significance of this mitzvah, of this commandment? Understand the war a little bit, and to understand the symbolism of the way they purify the items that were found from the war. So once again, I'd like to take two approaches. The first being based on the Nesiv of Shalom, the Slonimer Rebbe, and the second being based on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in a book we've used quite often, The Inside Story. The Nesiv of Shalom points out in Source 5a, he says, V'yesh lomar ha'inyan, שמלחמת מידיין אכן הייתה מלחמה כבדה מאוד על עצם קיומו של עם ישראל. The war of Midian was a tremendous war, not only against the physical aspects of the Jewish people, but עצם קיומו של עם ישראל, really the whole existence of the Jewish people, was at stake here. And he quotes that famous pasuk that we have in the book of Micha, where Micha tells the Jewish people, remember the story of Balak, of Moab, the whole story that happened. And the Zohar Kadosh notes, why is it so important to remember the story? Because he says, it's very powerful, fourth line, Shelo haita et sarah kasha yoter l'Israel. There was never such a difficult time for the Jewish people. Miyom heyotam l'goy kibishazu, from the moment they came a nation until this point. Av yoter me'eit shamdu alayam umimitzavam ha'kashar la'achar chayt ha'egel. This was a more dangerous time than when the Jewish people were at the Red Sea, and a more dangerous time than even at Chet Ha'Ikel. This was really a point of a breaking for the Jewish people. Why? Doesn't seem so terrible. Why? So he says that what Midian was trying to do was very similar to what Lavan was trying to do. Right? We speak about this in the Haggadah, that Lavan bikesh lakor takol, he tried to uproot everything. There are two ways of fighting. There's the one way of fighting, you know, this is a famous idea based on the Haggadah, the paro way of fighting, which means that you kill people. You annihilate people. It's a physical way of destroying a people. That's one way. It's a terrible way. But there's an even worse way than that way. And what's that? That's the Lavan. The Lavan, the white, is this aspect of trying to destroy people based on their Jewish identity. If you destroy their Jewish identity, you destroy any connection to their Judaism, so then, and it could be through love, that's how Lavan tried to do it, through assimilation. You lose, and we see the Holocaust that's going on, what we call the silent Holocaust of today in America, is losing a tremendous amount of people, almost as powerful in the proportion as the Holocaust that we experienced many years ago. This is another type of destroying of the Jewish people. It's not the paro aspect, it's the Lavan aspect. And this is what Midian really represented. Midian didn't go out with arms to fight against us. What did they do? They went out with their women. They tried to entice us to join up with their religion and in that way try to destroy us. This was a level of trying to make us completely distance, a payroot, a complete difference between us and God. And that is a very serious war. And that's why when we're fighting Midian here, although we're fighting them physically, Levi too has to go out. Because it's really the Levi aspect, it's the righteous people who have to fight this war. Because it's not just a war of an army of guns and swords and bows and arrows, whatever they used in those days. But it's a much deeper war, it's a war about Jewish identity. What they tried to do was to cut off our connection with God, to entice us into all these acts of promiscuity, and then worship their avodah zarah, worship their idol, and in that way, to cut ourselves off both intellectually as well as emotionally from God. And that's why he notes in 5b that this war is not only a war of a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. The war of Midian is really a constant war. It's the constant battle that we face. That's why the pasuk says, "Sarurim heim lachem," they are constantly involved in causing harm to you. It wasn't just a one-time battle. The battle of Midian is really a constant battle of fighting this aspect of life that tries to bring us farther and farther away from God. It's the darkness that envelops a person that tries to create this distance between us and God. And that's why he notes that the whole process of the purification of the vessels that came from the Midianites is really to raise up the sparks of holiness, a very Hasidic idea, that they captured by enticing us. That they took away some aspects of our Kedusha, of our holiness, and our job and our challenge is to elevate that, to immerse it in water and to bring it back up to godliness. Let's try to develop this war of Midian on one level. Because it's a war of Midian that we face really at all times. It's a war of how do we bring ourselves back to a level of closeness with God. Midian represents la'akor et hakol, to uproot our relationship to God. The war of Midian is to make a concerted effort to be reconnected. It's interesting because that's really the nekuda, the point of the 3 weeks. The Rav Chaim Friedlander in Siftei Chaim in Source 6 notes that what is the Avelus al Yushalayim, what is the mourning of Jerusalem that we're undergoing now during these 3 weeks period? It's a very difficult time to really get our hands on. He says, Lahardish v'lachush et chisron va'edek kvod shamayim v'abriya. You know what we're mourning now? We're not only mourning a building that was destroyed, a Beis HaMikdash, a temple thousands of years ago. That's so distant from us. We're mourning something much more deeper than that. We're mourning the fact that we don't have Kvod Shamayim, we don't have Gilui Kvod Shamayim, we don't have God's presence really felt on a tangible level in our lives. And that's what we're mourning. And that's why he says the Sifrei Chaim so beautifully. If you just but want to have this, if you feel bad that your life is not more connected to God, that we don't feel godliness as much as we should in our lives, so then you're mourning over the destruction of Jerusalem. That's the mourning. The mourning is that we're not as close as we want to be. How do we create this connection? How do we fight Midyan on this level and reconnect with God? So the answer is simple. The answer is simple. To implement it might be a little more difficult, but the answer is simple. That's a famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, brought down in source number 7, V'chol ma'asecha yiyu l'shem shamayim. Let all your deeds be for the sake of heaven. Rabbi Bunim in Ethics from Sinai notes, we know that Judaism does not outlaw or prohibit the physical pleasures of life. Eating, drinking, marriage are all integral parts of the total life of the Jew. But since actions for physical pleasure are so closely related to the bestial and ugly, how can they form an integral part of a spiritual life in Torah? So Rabbi Yossi advises, let all your deeds be for the sake of heaven. Endow these activities with the right intentions, with a proper purpose. Why should we eat? To keep the body healthy. Why do we need a healthy body? So that our minds may also be healthy, that we may be mentally and physically able to observe the mitzvot and be complete Jews. Thus, even the most lowly activity can be done for the sake of heaven as part of worship of the Almighty. In any act that we do, ask ourselves, are we doing this to create a relationship with God? Are we doing this in order to enable myself as an individual to have the energy, to have the strength, in order to bring about a Gilui Kvod Shamayim, a revelation of godliness in this world? Am I doing it for myself, or am I doing it beyond myself to bring myself to a level of connection with God? And he quotes a wonderful idea of Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who quotes a pasuk in Yeshaya in source 8, where the pasuk says, as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and does not return there until it waters the earth and makes it bare and sprout, giving produce to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall be my word that goes forth from my mouth, that shall not return to me empty, until it shall accomplish that which I have wanted and succeed where I have sent it. So rain doesn't go back into heaven in the whole cycle until it first waters down here and produces nourishment down here. So Chaim Bevelushin, on a play of words, notes in source number 9 that the word Geshem, rain, also denotes physical matter in general. It's our religious belief, Gashmiut, right? It's our religious belief that all physical blessings come from heaven, bestowed upon us by a beneficent Almighty. But in what sense do they return there? The chemical processes of nature are not one way, but rather secular. And that's the same thing that goes on with us. We merit all material things by the grace of heaven. The secular return to heaven is accomplished when a person responds with a bracha, a blessing, acknowledging his indebtedness and gratitude to the Almighty. It is achieved when a person uses the bounty he has received to live a life under Torah, when he knows God in all his ways and conducts his physical activities with a central spiritual intent. In this matter, physical matter leads to spiritual values, and the word of God returns, the cycle of providence is complete. So it's a very beautiful idea that just like rain only returns in the whole cycle once it's accomplished, that which has to accomplish, when God gives us gashmius, when God gives us the physical matters in life, our challenge is to allow them to be once again elevated and brought up back to God. That's what life is about. Life is not about living in a vacuum. Life is about taking the blessings of God and being able to utilize them, v'chol ma'asecha yiyu l'shem shamayim, for God, to bring about godliness in this world, to bring about a connection. It's the anti-Midyan approach. When Midyan tries to, on a philosophical level, detach us from God, we need to attach ourselves to God. If this is true on a level of our physical possessions, of eating, of drinking, of the pleasures of this world, to be able to find ways how to elevate them, it's really true about life itself. And this is really what life is about. Rabbi Hirsch's 19 letters, very famous essays of Rav Hirsch, which I'm sure many of us have learned, he has a wonderful selection beginning in source 10, where he says, the law to which all forces submit instinctively and involuntarily to this law, you too, are to subordinate yourself, but consciously of your own free will. All forces are ranged in service around God's throne. You, man, your countenance is half uncovered, your place is part revealed to you. You're able to regard and consecrate yourself as a servant of God. You're able to gain an inkling of your mission as God has attuned your ear to perceive it. We're involved in this life in being an Eved Hashem, a servant of God. That's why we're here. And he says, and this again should be blown up and put in front of our faces every day, 11a. Our purpose in life, therefore, is not the acquisition of possession. We should not measure our achievement in life by the volume of outer or inner treasures that we accumulate. Our life's mission is concerned with what we become, what we make of ourselves, what we give, not what we get. We should measure our attainments by the extent to which we fulfill God's will with the help of our outer and inner acquisitions, utilizing every single one, small or large, for truly human deeds of divine service. Our endeavors to acquire inner and outer possession have value only because they provide us with the means to perform such deeds. So it's not only the physical aspects of life which are there in order to elevate ourselves to God, it's our whole being and everything that we have, all the talents, all the gifts that we're given. Our whole challenge in life is to take all of them and use them for the service of God. As he says so beautifully in B, all of one's capabilities are but tools lent to you, which one day will appear before the throne of God as witnesses for or against you, testifying whether you neglected them or used them well. Moving to C, thus happiness and perfection consist of using all one's outer and inner possession in fullest measure according to God's will, which is alone what makes man great. And he says in 13, whoever in his lifetime fulfilled the will of God toward the creatures born into his orbit, wronging none, assisting each one to the best of his ability, to reach the goal that God intended for it, he was truly man. Whether in luxury or privation, abundance or want, whether with tears of joy or sorrow, such a human personality, unchanging almost like God, sees in every new blessing as in every loss, merely another challenge to tackle anew the same unchanging task. We're here in life to use everything that we have for the service of God. There's a wonderful idea of Rav Moshe on this point of Rav Hirsch, that in fact my husband said at the Kiddush when our daughter was born, and I think that this is really a summation of what life is all about, and a blessing you would like to give to any person, particularly a young person, in terms of direction. The Pasuk says in Parshas Va'era, that was when the Kiddush was, Pasuk says, "Hu Aaron uMoshe." This is Aaron and Moshe who are being sent to be the leaders of the Jewish people going down to Egypt. So Rashi notes, how come sometimes it says Moshe and Aaron, other times it says Aaron and Moshe? How come the order is sometimes reversed? So says Rashi, to teach us, Shishkulim Ke'echa, they're really one. They're really one? They're really equal? They're equal? Moshe Rabbeinu, there was never a Navi who arose like Moshe Rabbeinu, a prophet who was on the level of Moshe, and you're telling me they're one, they're equal? How can that be? So Rav Moshe gives two answers. The second answer that he gives is that Aaron, his whole life and his whole service, that which he had to do, he did and fulfilled with the same completion as Moshe had with his life and his goals in his life. Which means what? In what way were they equal? They weren't equal in the sense of they reached the same goal in life. They were equal in that each was able to fulfill the potential that they had within them to reach the goal that they had to reach in life. And he quotes a wonderful story of Rav Moshe, a story found in the Gemara, of Yosef, the son of Rabbi Yeshua, who became very sick. And he's like in this, I don't know, state where he saw a vision of the next world. And when he got better and his father said to him, what did you see? He said, I saw a topsy-turvy world up there. So he says, what do you mean? So the way the Gemara explains the story is the following. He says that the people who were great people down here were great people up in heaven. And the people who weren't so great down here weren't so great in heaven. But what was the difference? Down here, the great people were, you know, are looked upon as great. And the not so great people aren't looked down as not so great. But in heaven, the great people are looked upon as not so great. And the not so great people are looked upon as great. What does that mean? So says the Gemara the following. The people who we look at as great are great in terms of their potential is great. But if they're not going to use all that potential, so the Olam HaEmes in the real world, they're not looked upon as so great. And those who perhaps may not have such great capabilities in this world, we look at them as, you know, I don't know, what we call a Pashut Yid, a simple person. But in Shemayim, they're looked upon as really great. Why? Because being that simple person, the capabilities they have, this is what they've accomplished, is tremendous. We live in such a society which is focused on goal orientation, of what you can achieve in life. How many letters can you have after your name? And if you can't achieve it, if you're not successful and you haven't made it as a COO of your company, whatever it is, so you haven't made it. That's what Judaism says. Judaism says, is, let's look at the capabilities you were given. Not everyone's born brilliant. That happens to be a fact. Right? There's a certain level of IQ that you can't change, or certain capabilities you can't change. This is where life is at. But given those capabilities, you then utilize them to your fullest. But while yet a person who was born with a tremendous amount of potential and tremendous energy was invested in them, and they don't utilize it, so then it's really what we look at as a topsy-turvy world is the real world. That one who uses their potential is really on top of the ladder, and one who doesn't use their potential is on the bottom of the ladder. I'd just like to add one parenthetical point, because as a teacher, I feel very strongly about this. This is why, as an individual, I feel very strongly, and I fought for it for years, against awards. Particularly in elementary school, I had this problem, where they would give awards out to the best. When the awards were given for academic excellence, and I think that we're sending the wrong message to the kids. This is, again, a personal interjection here. Because a kid who is a D kid and then suddenly gets a 70 on a test, well, that kid is doing far greater than a kid who gets a 98 on a test without studying. And that's what we have to, that's what we have to reward. There's a beautiful story that I read recently in a book called Visions of Greatness, by, I think by Weiss. He speaks about a young boy who was not into learning, who was not into his studies, and one day he decided before a Chumash test to stumble into the Beis Medrash and maybe, you know, pick up a book. And he walked in there, and the Rebbe was in the Beis Medrash, and the Rebbe said hello to all the boys and didn't even look at him because, you know, he was like the low life of the class. And the kid was very, very hurt. He says, I'm going to come back next week and show the Rebbe that I can really be here and learn. And he came by the next week, and the Rebbe noticed him and said, wow, I'm really impressed that you're here. It means so much to me, you know, keep up the good work. And that gave the kid such a lift in life, and he said, you know what, I'm going to show this Rebbe that I can do it. And he spent the whole next year really, really, really striving to be the best he could. At the end of the year, awards were given out, and he said to himself, 3 awards were given out. He said to himself, I'm going to get one of these awards because I really worked hard this year. The first award was given out, he says, for sure, this kid deserves it. He's like the brain of the class. And the second award was given out, well, he really deserves it. He's also very smart. But the third award is going to go to me because I really worked hard. And the principal announces the third award, and it goes to a different kid. And the kid is just heartbroken. And he comes to school the next day, doesn't want to look at anybody. And the Rebbe, and this is the sensitivity of a teacher, goes over to him and says, I know you were upset you didn't get the award yesterday. But you really deserve the award of a smada of really trying to work hard. And I acknowledge all the effort you've put in. And it turns out that this young boy became a Rebbe himself, a teacher himself, because of this teacher. And he says, I went into education in order to make sure that no kid falls through the cracks. That even if a kid doesn't get an award based on, quote unquote, the system, every kid is recognized for the ability that they put in. And that's what we need to focus in on life. So moving away from education, back to ourselves as individuals, that's the question we need to ask ourselves. Is not, oh, I've accomplished a tremendous amount. Well, perhaps it didn't take any effort. But are we able to say that we're able to take all that God has given us and elevate it for God? And that's why, in a nutshell, Rabbi Yerucham in Das Chochma Musar in Source 17 explains, he says, if you had to suggest one item that would have a major effect on a person's life, he says, constantly focus on the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, of all your actions should be for the sake of the Almighty, when you meditate on this Mishnah, you will experience the elevated state of cleaving to and being connected with God with each and every movement you make. And this explains on this level the vessels in the mikvah. Rav Hirsch, also quoted by Rabbi Kaplan in Waters of Eden, Source 18, explains that the use of metal represents one of man's major steps towards civilization. Rav Hirsch explains that a metal utensil is therefore the most visible sign of man's intelligent mastery over the earth and its material. Not only the shape, but the use of the material itself proclaims this fact. This explains why metal vessels have a special status. Since glass is processed and melted like metal, it also has a status. Eating, on the other hand, is an activity that primarily belongs to the animal sphere of man's nature. When a metal utensil is used for eating, this therefore represents man's highest mental faculties being employed to serve his animal nature. The Torah requires, however, that even the most physical of man's activities be elevated to the realm of the spiritual. Before using a metal utensil for eating, we must first sanctify and elevate it to a level of holiness by immersion in the mikvah. The vessel will in turn sanctify the food served in it. In this manner, a Jew's eating utensils become like the consecrated vessel of the Holy Temple, which sanctify anything that was placed in them. Level number one, the war of Midian, is not just a war on a physical nation, it's a war on what Midian represented. Midian represented the fight against our connection to God, of love on Bikesh Lakorta Kol, to uproot us, to get us as far away from God as possible, to seduce us into sin, to seduce us into a distant relationship from God. The war of Midian therefore has to be fought by Levi, by righteous people, because it's not only a physical war, it's a spiritual war to bring about a Kilui Kvod Shamayim, a revelation of godliness in this world. How do we fight this war? We fight this war very simply by making a conscious effort to ask ourselves, what we're doing at this moment, do we feel that we're coming closer to God? Do we feel that we're elevating ourselves to relationship with God? And in our lives in general, do we feel that our lives are being led as a Kiddush Hashem? Do we feel that we are coming closer to God and feeling that we're having a purpose in this world and utilizing everything that we have in fulfilling our mission in this world? The immersion of these utensils, therefore, the metal which shows the mastery of man in this world, the food that we eat, everything has to be immersed in order to represent this idea that the physical aspects of life have to be elevated for God. That's level one. Level two, based on the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe, also looks at the war of Midian as not just a physical battle. There's just far too much attention given in the Torah over this war. Take a look at the war of Sichon and Og at the end of Parshas Chukas, 4-5, looking finished. Goodbye. You look at this, it's pages and pages of all these details. There has to be something about this war that's not just a regular war. So, explains the Lubavitcher Rebbe the following 19. He says, each individual human being is a virtual world of personalities and character traits, a planet of nations constantly at battle over the territories and resources of body and soul. Love battles pride, anger battles empathy, will battles sloth, mind struggles with heart. Here too, the war of Midian is unique, a war unlike any other waged on the battleground of the soul. The Hebrew word Midian itself means strife. The war on Midian, then, is not a conflict involving some specific region of the human universe. It is a war on war itself, on the very phenomenon of dichotomy and discord within man. For man, in essence, is a unified, harmonious world, an integrated community with a common goal. It is the Midian in man that is the source of all disharmony and strife within and constantly without. Midian is a fragmentation of the human soul. We are basically composed of, as we spoke about just now, one in terms of our service of God, that we're here to accomplish one mission. What does Midian come and do? Midian comes and makes fragmentations of our life, makes this inner discord within our life, and makes us focused in so many different directions that we don't even know where to begin to battle. The battle on Midian is really the battle on the discord and the disharmony within ourselves. war breaks out in the heart of man when its component parts lose sight of the singular objective which spawned them, so that each assumes an ego, an agenda of its own. And that leads to confusion, and that leads to so many problems that we have within our lives. And he says the reasons men and nations have for hating and destroying each other are various facades of the divisive eye of Midyan, the ego that belies the common source and goal of humanity and views the very existence of others as encroachment upon the self. So although Levi remains aloof, usually, from the mundane struggles of life, we need to take the Levi within us. We need to take even the spiritual part within us. When it comes to war, Midyan, every tribe and facet of the soul must take up arms. Indeed, it is only with the participation of the Levite within, the element of self most in touch with the singular essence, that the battle and strife can be waged. We need Levi because Levi gives us focus in life. Levi represents the spiritual aspect of our life. That needs to be used in order for us to gain focus on what life is all about. On this level of Midyan, it's the battle that we fight every single day in our lives, and we don't know where to put our priorities. We don't know where to put our focus. We don't know where we should put our energy. And this part of us calls for us, and that part of us calls for us, and we feel this is really important, and that's really important. And sometimes we're struggling so much to decide what's really important that what happens in the end, nothing gets done. Nothing gets done, except this battle. And we lose focus. And we lose focus. The lazy part of us that has to fight this war of Midyan says that there is a spiritual core, that the spiritual core has to give direction, has to give some input on what's really important in life and to get focused in life. We know people who go through so many inner conflicts in life that it almost paralyzes them that they can't move further in life. I had that yesterday. I had a young lady at my house, Rochelle Shudis, who's a college student, who is deciding between three majors in college. Three completely different fields, left, right, and center. And where is she going to go? I don't know. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this. She'll try a little bit. And if she doesn't make a decision soon, what's going to happen? She's going to fall right through the center. She's going to miss out on all opportunities. At times, you have to be able to reconcile, well, which direction are you going in? Because you can't go simultaneously in three directions of economics, education, and medicine. They're just all not going to happen at the same time. Unless you're very creative, I guess. 22. How does one battle Midyan? So the Rebbe says something very interesting. How does one restore the divine unity to a fragmented world? By delving even further into plurality. For such is the paradox of life. The more something is broken down to its particulars, the more we uncover opportunity for unity. Take, for example, he gives two. We'll take a look at them briefly. 23. If you have two physical substances, your five senses perceive them as different and unconnected, but place them under a microscope and you'll discover they are comprised of similar components. They might even share an element or two. The deeper you delve, descending to the molecular, atomic, and subatomic levels, the more unanimity you will find and the more ways you'll discover to harness these diverse substances toward a singular aim. And the same is true of nations. On the surface, their goals and aspirations run counter to each other, giving rise to conflict and strife. But dissect these goals item by item, and you will inevitably find areas in which they overlap and complement each other. And this common ground that you will then be able to build on. Right? Pliskin tells the story in his book on marriage, where he says that two people came to a marriage counselor, to a rabbi, and they say, we don't agree on anything. We fight about everything. From A to Z, there's not one common ground that we have in common. So the marriage counselor, the rabbi, I don't know who was in this case, said to the husband, why are you here? Because I want to have a better marriage. And turned to the wife and, why are you here? Because I want to have a better marriage. Ah, you already see that you have a common ground between you. Okay, so if you start from there, you'll notice that you have more common ground than you even thought. And that's why he says, 25, we introduce a new factor into the cosmic equation called harmony. We evolve from the ultimate singularity which we were born with to plurality, to diversity, which is part of life. But diversity need not disintegrate into strife. Instead, the diversity can be further dissected into the ingredients of harmony, a harmony that mirrors the singularity out of which the entire process was born. So we start with one goal, we get caught up in life, in midjan, in strength, in seeing things on many different levels. Step back and see, well, what are the components that are the same? What are the goals that are the same? In this young lady's case, what is it that she wants to do in life? In all endeavors, if there's some aspect of wanting to give to humanity, whatever it is that you can find that are the same and use that as the building block to give direction, use that as the building block of harmony. If that's the war on Midyan, it's the war of trying to see the harmony within the diversity. So we can explain on a deeper level, and this will be our last idea for the morning, of why it was specifically that all utensils had to be immersed in a mikveh, in a pool of water. What does a mikveh represent? So there's a wonderful insight that Rabbi Kaplan brings, and his name of the book, Waters of Eden, is based on this, a book I highly recommend. He says the following. He says, if we look in the book of Bereishit, in the book of Genesis, in describing the whole story of the Garden of Eden, take a look together in source 26. From the second chapter of the book of Genesis, God planted a garden in Eden to the east, and there he placed the man that he had formed, and God made the ground grow every tree that is pleasant to see and good to eat, and tree of life in the middle of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, so the whole description of the garden. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it split and became four headwaters, and it lists the four headwaters. And God took the man and placed it in the Garden of Eden to work it and to watch it, and he commanded him, you can eat from every tree except for one. So, based on the Malbim who asked, why is it that the water is mentioned here? It seems to have absolutely no connection to the story. Okay, so it watered the ground, but then to go through the detail that it went out in four directions, Prat, Chidekel, and list all the different tributaries that came from it, who really needs to know this? It really doesn't seem to have any connection with the story of the Garden of Eden. So he explains, taking philosophy in a very short bite right now, that we know in 28 that evil was not part of man, an outside force he could easily avoid. But once man partook of the tree, the same became true of him, where evil existed within him. It was intermingled. It was a tree of good and evil, where you really couldn't discern the good and the evil. And that was the result of eating of the tree. At that moment, evil became an intrinsic part of his being. Man was now a mixture of good and evil, and he had to spend all his days fighting this evil and attempting to overcome it. Man's very essence now became filled with contradiction. His life became full of conflict, resulting in frustrations, making a perfect society for all but impossible, causing mental anguish and imperfection. And therefore, he says in 30, ultimately, all uncleanliness is a result of Adam's sin. Death and all other human imperfection was a result of this sin. If man could have remained in his elevated state in the Garden of Eden, nothing would exist that could cause uncleanliness. This explains why a person who has been defiled by something unclean was not allowed to enter the grounds of the Holy Temple. The temple represents a miniature Garden of Eden. When Adam sinned, he was driven from this garden. Therefore, anything associated with the sin prevents him from entering the miniature Garden of Eden, that is the temple. So when a person is in a state of impurity, you can't enter into the model of the Garden of Eden, which was the temple. How do we disassociate oneself from man's fallen state and reassociate himself with Eden and allow him once again to enter into the temple? The purification is primarily through water, through immersion in the mikveh. Water is the primary connection that we have with the Garden of Eden. And this is the key, third paragraph in 31. The Talmud tells us that all the water in the world ultimately has its root in the river that emerged from Eden. In a sense, this river is the spiritual source of all water. Even though a person cannot re-enter the Garden of Eden itself, whenever he associates himself with these rivers or with any other water, he is re-establishing his link with Eden. And now we understand why the river was thrown in the middle of the story. The Torah tells us that God planted the garden and in it the tree of good and evil. With it, the possibility was created that man would sin and be evicted from Eden. Thus, even before God placed man in Eden, he established a link between the garden and the world outside, namely the river which emerged from Eden. It's a beautiful idea of the Malbim. So why is the river found in this whole account? It really doesn't belong here. It's what we call the refuah before the makkah, the healing before the sickness. That we have planted in the garden the tree of good and evil with the potential for evil. How do we reinstate ourselves to a level of good? Well, that's why the river is there, because the river, all waters that which come in this world come from those original four waters, which are all connected in the Garden of Eden. So anytime one immerses oneself in a water on a metaphysical level, one is really immersing oneself in the waters of Eden. So that's why even though man has been expelled from Eden, a link remains. And with this, he explains the metal that we are dealing with in our parsha. He says, 33, another manifestation, man's fallen state, is the basic conflict between man and the world around him. In many respects, metal represents man's ability to destroy nature. Therefore, this too is a basic manifestation, man's lack of harmony with nature. Rather than being a sign of man's perfection, civilization is something that was necessitated by man's lack of natural harmony with nature. His use of metal utensils is therefore still a sign of his expulsion from Eden. In essence, then, just as Anida represents humanity's basic conflict with its own reproductive process, man's use of metal utensils for eating also represents the conflict of its intellect with respect to another of the natural functions, namely eating. And that's why metal vessels must reestablish their harmony with nature through their association with the waters of Eden, just like Anida must do so with respect to her sexuality. And it's particularly important in our context because it's really a war of the sexual misconduct with the war of the daughters of Midian. The spoil, 37, that the Israelites brought back, the gold, the silver, the copper, the iron, etc., they were obtained through idolatry, harlotry, and killing, underscored the fact that these utensils would also are indicative of man's fallen state. Therefore, before they could be used, they too had to be re-elevated through the mikvah. So on this level, I think the connection of the second level is very clear. Midian represents the disharmony in man. The disharmony of man came about through the sin of Adam, through the fall in the Garden of Eden. Because of that fall, we have this conflict within us. We have this good and evil within us. And that's why the mikvah represents, the water represents our ability to come back to the source, to come back to the Garden of Eden, and to purify and to elevate all the difficult conflicts that we come through, and to be able to immerse ourselves back in spirituality, to get back in touch with the Garden of Eden, with the spiritual core of this world. And I think that that's what the Rebbe is talking about on a certain level. That within the conflicts within us, we have to find that mikvah. We have to find that source of water. We have to find that point of unity, that point of purification, that point of focus in order to elevate our lives. So in summation, to answer our original question, what was so special about this war of Midian that Levi had to be used? Why the immersions in the mikvahs of Chukas HaTorah? Because we're not just talking here about a war of Midian and a war of immersion of vessels. We're talking about life in general. Doing that life on one level, the war of Midian is the war of distancing us from God, la'akor takol, to utterly remove us in our relationship. Our challenge in fighting Midian is to elevate all aspects of our life to the service of God. To take the physical utensils, immerse them in a mikvah, and say everything has to be elevated for God. Our whole life has to be a gilui kvod shamayim, an elevation of godliness. Lo chukas haTorah, that's the law of the Torah, that's what life is about. On the second level, the war of Midian is a very personal war within us, within the conflicts that go on in our lives, and the disharmony that's found within our own lives. With that, we have to find the common element. All those different voices that call at us to different parts of our day really have one underlying message. Let's find that, let's be able to take those messages from those different voices and to try to bring them into some type of harmony that allows us direction in life. And that's the concept of the immersion in the mikvah. As a result of the sin of the Garden of Eden, we have all these conflicts. To be able to go back to the water means going back to the source, connecting back to the Garden of Eden. That's what we have to find within our own lives, that wellspring of water that connects us back to our spiritual core and our service of God.